From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Australian actress Toni Collette adopted a Philadelphia accent to play Haley Joel Osment's mother in the thriller The Sixth Sense. And she gained 40 pounds to play a socially awkward daydreamer in Muriel's Wedding. Now she's playing five roles in one in the Showtime series The United States of Tara, where she won an Emmy for her performance as a wife and mom who has multiple personalities. Also, why blockbuster films and teen audiences drive the film industry. We talk with journalist Edward J. Epstein, author of The Hollywood Economist. And Mustang Sally and In the Midnight Hour were two of the hits by soul singer Wilson Pickett. A new box set of his Atlantic recordings has just been released. Rock historian Ed Ward tells us his story. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. My guest is Australian actress Toni Collette. Her habit of taking on diverse roles and her talent for character transformation sometimes leave audiences unaware she's the same actress they've seen in other performances. Collette got an Oscar nomination for her supporting role in The Sixth Sense. Among her other films are Muriel's Wedding, Velvet Goldmine, About a Boy, The Hours, In Her Shoes, and Little Miss Sunshine. Collette's talents are currently showcased in the Showtime series The United States of Tara, where she plays a mom with dissociative identity disorder, once known as multiple personality syndrome.
I just really resent picking up after them. I mean, not the kids. The alters. The messes they make can be astounding. I mean, having multiple personalities is like hosting a kegger in your brain. Only you're passed out cold while everyone else is just trashing the joint.
Toni Collette won an Emmy and a Golden Globe Award for her portrayal of Tara. In season two, which began last week, Tara and her family think they've finally vanquished the alternate personalities who haven't appeared in months. But it turns out they're wrong. I recently spoke to Toni Collette. We began with a montage of some of the alternative personalities in the series. First, we hear Buck, a macho guy, talking to Tara's husband, Max. Then we hear T, a rebellious 15-year-old, talking to Tara's daughter, Kate. And finally, it's Tara herself, talking to her understanding son, Marshall, after the teenager, T, has had control of her body for a few hours.
Hey, don't smoke in here, okay, man?
I only smoke when I party.
Well, this isn't a party.
This is you.
Are those my new skinny jeans?
Don't they make my ass look fine?
Sure, fine for 40.
Do you know how much it blows being 15 and stuck in this ancient body? I mean, look, I have a muffin top.
Must suck.
You suck.
How was she? T, I mean.
She wasn't that bad. I mean, she was only here for a couple hours. Do you know she's a vegetarian now?
Am I high?
Maybe a little, yeah.
Listen, I want to thank you for being such a strong, supportive kid. I'm really lucky.
We're lucky, Mom. I mean, because of you, we get to be interesting.
You like being interesting?
I love it.
I think I have the munchies. You want anything from the kitchen?
And that's our guest, Toni Collette. Toni Collette and Toni Collette from the United States of Tara, playing the main character, Tara, and then two of the alternative identities that the character becomes from time to time. Is there a difference between playing these different characters as alternate personalities of the same person? Is that different from playing them as if they were independent, freestanding characters?
I try to do both, actually. I want the audience to be able to invest in each of the alters and to believe them wholeheartedly. So I try to make them as complex and as real and as whole as possible. But at the same time, they're all part of Tara. They all represent something that she can't quite access or that is repressed, and that's literally why they exist. So I'm conscious of why they exist and in two ways.
You know, this is a very physical role, well, or series of roles, because when you become an alter and you transform yourself, I mean, you do amazing things with your voice, but you also physically become a different person. And in some cases, there are people who are at odds with the body that they occupy. It's a 15-year-old kid in a 40-year-old person's body. It's a macho male kind of truck driving sort of guy in a housewife's body. How does that affect the way you do this?
in reading a script, and I have the luxury of working with such fabulous material on this show, I find that characters either leap off the page and they're complete as I read them. I hear them and I feel them and I see them and I taste them, and it's a very immediate response. And there's almost not too far to travel to make them whole, you know. So, you know, with T, she was very clear and very immediate.
That's the teenager, right? Yeah.
That's right, yeah. She's 15 and, you know, she, I guess, represents a kind of escapism and irresponsibility and just giving her finger to the world and complete self-indulgence. And so I wanted her to physically just be moving out in all directions and kind of sloppy. With Alice, she's very tightly wound. We haven't talked about her, but she's the 1950s homemaker, and she's kind of the most controlling of the alters. She represents a kind of a need for order, and can be manipulative in trying to achieve that.
The aggressively conventional mom, in a way. Yeah,
yeah. Right, yeah. Right. But everything's just under the surface with her. She keeps a smile at all times, but still gets her way. But she's quite anal, which I quite enjoy. And Buck, I was most nervous about creating Buck because, first of all, I didn't want him to be a cliche, and I also didn't want him to become laughable and for the audience to, you know, just be taken with the idea of a woman playing a guy. I wanted the audience to be able to relate to Buck or invest in him as a character as much as the female alters. And so with that particular alter, I hung out with some fairly masculine blokes and just to get a few tips on the physicality. And you know, I tried to avoid giving Buck a southern accent, but I always came back to it. I thought it would be too much of a cliche, but somehow it works, and it was kind of inescapable in a way. It's what I first heard, and I just kept coming back to it.
In the United States of Terror, you know, one of these roles is a 15-year-old kid, and you have to pull off being a teenager. And I know that you took this role on just a few months after you'd given birth to your daughter.
And that 3 months.
And you know, it works. Was it hard kind of getting into shape and trusting that you could pull that off?
Abso-friggin-lutely. And I was petrified. This was my first child, and it was the most heart-opening experience. I've never felt so vulnerable in my life. And then to have to be so physical in front of a crew that I didn't know and knowing that it would be seen by others eventually was really a little bit scary and exciting. I like putting myself in uncomfortable positions. There's something to gain from it. And I love the project on the whole, so I was willing to go there. But in terms of the physicality, you can't exercise straight away after having a child, and so I had to wait, I think, 6 weeks, and I was happy to wait. I was too busy staring at this brilliant new creature that I had in my arms. But once I started, I don't know, it was me connecting to the show before even arriving in LA to shoot the show. So it just started the ball rolling internally, I guess, as well, which was handy.
There's a scene where you, as Buck, I mean, the macho alternative identity, gets into a fight in a parking lot with a teenager who's one of your a kid who has been unkind to your daughter, and you're really going at it. I read that in this scene you actually caught the kid with a hard right and sent him to the hospital. Is this true?
I believe it was a hard left. Yes, but we did a few takes, and he had a lot of studs and spiky bits in his costume, so I didn't walk away unwounded. I had scratches and blood and bruises that lasted quite some time, but I felt quite proud of them because I've never done a fight scene before. Yes, I did clock him on the chin, and he didn't take it very well, actually. He had to do some press. I think the Toronto Film Festival was happening. He was getting on a plane the next morning, and he was the one who talked about going to hospital. But let me tell you, and the crew will back me up, he was fine.
Well, I wanted to dial the clock back a bit in your career and talk about Muriel's Wedding, which was a breakout role for you, got you a lot of attention, made, you know, in Australia, in your home. And we have a scene here where you're Muriel, and of course you're this sort of overweight woman who is insecure and obsessed with the music of the group ABBA and also obsessed with getting married, and has, in fact, at this point in the story, she's moved to Sydney to try to escape her old life and has made up a story that she's actually engaged to someone. She wants to be married to someone named Tim Sims. And in this scene, her friend, who's played by Rachel Griffiths, discovers that Muriel has been visiting bridal shops everywhere and trying on gowns, and she comes in to confront her.
What is going on, Muriel? I've seen your wedding album. You've tried on every dress in Sydney.
That doesn't mean I'm getting married.
What else does it mean?
I want to get married. I've always wanted to get married. If I can get married, it means I've changed. I'm a new person.
How?
Because who'd want to marry me?
Tim Sims.
There is no Tim Sims. I made him up. In Pulpit Spit, no one would even look at me. But when I came to Sydney and became Mario, Bryce asked me out. And that proves I'm already different than I was. And if someone wants to marry me, I'm not her anymore. I'm me.
Her?
Muriel! Muriel Heslop! Stupid, fat and useless. I hate her. I'm not going back to being her again. Oh, why can't it be me? Why can't I be the one?
And that's our guest, Toni Collette, with Rachel Griffiths in the film Muriel's Wedding. You grew up in a working-class suburb of Sydney yourself, right? Do you identify with Muriel and her character at all?
Absolutely. When I read the script, I just had to communicate to PJ that it had to be me. I had to be the one. I just thought there's nobody else who can help tell this story. I totally understand this person, and I have to do it.
You know, I hope you'll forgive me if I ask you a question that I know you've probably been asked so many times that you're tired of it. But this involves an incident when I believe you were 11 years old, and I read that you faked the symptoms of appendicitis so accurately that a healthy appendix was actually removed from you. Do you have much memory of that event?
Not really. I mean, I don't. It's so embarrassing. I don't know why I did it. I remember my mother telling me that when she was 11, she had her appendix out. And I was like, well, how did you know that was the problem? And she said, when the doctor pressed on the spot, it didn't hurt. It was when he released his hand is when she felt pain. So I guess I wanted the day off school and I faked it. And I, you know, acted accordingly when he released his hand. And then he ordered me into the emergency room, and I just never I never owned up to it. And I know that a lot of people say that actors are needy of attention, and I hate to admit it, but perhaps that was part of that, because I don't see myself as a very needy person. I try to shun any kind of attention that I get and focus on my work. But at that point, perhaps that was part of that embarrassing occurrence.
You know, looking back at Muriel's Wedding, this film that was, you know, a real takeoff point for your career, you know, a lot of people would not recognize the Toni Collette when they look at that film today, because, you know, you're much heavier. And I read that you gained 40 pounds for the role. I mean,
43.
Now, were you
every
asked,
pound counts.
Were you asked to do this? I mean, how did that
yes.
happen?
Well, she was written as an overweight young woman, and that was definitely something they were determined for me to do. I know people wear fat suits, but they definitely were fattening me up. In fact, I do remember coming to New York for the first time and doing a whole heap of press, and I remember people being fascinated when they were informed that I'd put on weight, that a young woman would do that. But if I love a character, I wouldn't do it again. I've done it a few times since, and I think the older you get, you don't have the bounce back, and it's not quite as healthy. But people were really fascinated, and I don't know, it seemed oddly acceptable for a male actor, but for a female, oh my God, how can you possibly? And I was kind of outraged by that.
We're speaking with Toni Collette. Her series, The United States of Tara, is now in its second season. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guest is actress Toni Collette. She stars in the Showtime series, The United States of Tara, which is now in its second season. Well, in 1999, you got an Oscar nomination for your role in The Sixth Sense, the M. Night Shyamalan film. And in this film, you're a struggling single mother who has this kid who sees ghosts. And I thought we'd listen to a scene where you're at the dinner table with him, and you're asking him about the fact that your late mother's special bumblebee pendant seems to disappear from your room and end up in your son's room, even though he says he's not taking it. Let's listen to the conversation.
So who moved it this time? Maybe someone came in our house, took the bumblebee pendant out of my closet and placed it nicely in your drawer.
Maybe.
God, I am so tired, Cole. I'm tired in my body. I'm tired in my mind. I'm tired in my heart. I need some help. You know, I don't know if you noticed, but our little family isn't doing so good. I mean, I've been praying, but I must not be praying right. Looks like we're just gonna have to answer each other's prayers. If we can't talk to each other, we're not gonna make it. Now tell me, baby, I won't get mad, honey. Did you take the bumblebee pendant?
No.
You've had enough roast beef. You need to leave the table. Go!
And that's our guest, Toni Collette, in the film The Sixth Sense. A terrific role, terrific performance. Tell us how you got this part.
Oh, it's funny, you know. I was in New York, and I was desperate to work with Martin Scorsese. I went to audition for a part in a film he was making called Bringing Out the Dead. And whilst I was here, my agent sent me another script, and I didn't know much about it. He told me it was a new director, writer-director, and it was starring Bruce Willis. And no disrespect, but I just thought, I don't want to do a movie like that. I just made an assumption about the kind of film it was going to be. So I put off reading the script, and one night I was a little bit jet-lagged. I was up late, staying in a friend's apartment, and I thought, oh, hell, I'll pick it up. And I couldn't put it down, and I just thought it was absolutely brilliant. And we all know about the twist at the end now, but man, the way you feel when you're watching it, I felt that when I was reading it. It was just so intense and so beautiful. I thought it was this beautiful spiritual tale. So anyway, I went to meet Knight, and I auditioned, and that's that. I get a message one day from my agent, and I call him back from a... This was before cell phones, so it was just a payphone on the street. And he yelled down the phone, "Toni, you've been offered!" And I thought he was going to say, you know, the Scorsese film. And I screamed in the middle of the street, and he said, hang on, did you hear me? You've been offered The Sixth Sense. And I was like, oh, no. And I remember feeling disappointed, even though I liked it. Martin Scorsese, you know, is like the be-all and end-all. So I went back to my hotel room, and there were messages from Knight, and he wanted to talk to me before I was flying back to Australia, and I was avoiding his phone call because I was like, oh, God, I don't want to commit to this. What if the other one happens? The other one didn't happen. I ended up having an amazing experience on The Sixth Sense. I loved making the movie. I loved working with everyone on that. I've got some great friends from that film. And there you have it.
Could you tell us about the audition? I mean, do you remember what scene you did?
I remember I did the scene in the car at the end, and that's the scene that really made me want to do the movie. It's such a powerful and emotional scene. I also remember that prior to my trip to New York, I'd been in Mexico, and on my 25th birthday, I shaved my head, so I wasn't looking particularly Hollywood. So I was not insecure about that. I thought, oh, well, if they're going to hire me, they're going to hire me for what I can do. Everybody knows there's wigs out there. And luckily they did, yeah.
I have to ask why you shaved your head.
Because I was 25 and I was alive. And I had a lot of tequila.
Well, it'll grow back unlike a tattoo, which won't come off. You mentioned the scene.
A couple of those as well.
Okay. You were also in Little Miss Sunshine, which was a terrifically successful film. And in this one, you're the mom, kind of the one centered person surrounded by these folks who are so caught up in their own obsessions and agendas. And it's just a terrific film. But one of the interesting things, I read that this film, which was shot in a very short period of time, had this ensemble cast and that the directors who were a husband and wife team, Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris, had you all go on outings like bowling as in character, is that right?
Yeah, we had, I can't remember now if it was 1 or 2 weeks, but it was an extensive rehearsal period and a luxury in the film world. And yeah, it was really, they made it such great fun. And, you know, it was about all of us learning to feel comfortable with each other and as well as learning about the characters and building the characters. So part of that was, yeah, hopping in our van and going off on little adventures. One of which included bowling. I went bowling recently and got 6 strikes in one game. Things have improved.
Ooh, you're an athlete. You know, when you look at your work, there are so many different accents, all done just so beautifully and convincingly. Do you have a technique for this?
Not really. I mean, an accent can, in a way, be an entry into a character. I grew up watching a lot of American television, so the American sound has been in my psyche somehow for a long time and is quite familiar. So I think that does make it easier. Also, I think having a musicality about me, that helps in identifying different things in languages and getting them right. I've never struggled with it, and I know that some actors do, and I feel very blessed not to have to think about how I'm sounding when I'm acting. So I can just, you know, not have to think about the technicality of it and try and be more in the moment.
When you're shooting a film like The Sixth Sense and you have a working-class Philadelphia accent, does it stay with you when you're off the set?
No, I don't do that. I know some actors do. I've worked with them. And I just go back to this, what you hear now.
Uh-huh. Well, Toni Collette, it's been fun. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. That was a real trip down memory lane. Thanks so much.
Toni Collette stars in the Showtime series The United States of Tara. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Wiley, publisher of Hero of the Pacific, The Life of Marine Legend John Bassalone, available in bookstores and online. From the Annie E. Casey Foundation, working with low-income families to claim tax credits and achieve economic stability, on the web at aecf.org. And from Booz Allen Hamilton, strategy and technology consultants, at boozallen.com/ready for what's next. This is NPR.
Coming up, Ed Ward profiles soul singer Wilson Pickett. The new box set Funky Midnight Mover collects his Atlantic recordings. Also, most of Hollywood's profits used to come from the box office. Not anymore. We talk with Edward J. Epstein about his new book, The Hollywood Economist. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross. Everyone knows that movies cost millions and make millions, and that we're paying a lot more for tickets than we used to. But did you ever wonder how the box office take is split among the theaters, the studios, the artists, and the video stores? Our next guest, Edward J. Epstein, has spent years figuring out the finances of the movie business, And he says power relationships in Hollywood explain a lot about why movies follow predictable formulas and why independent films are hard to make and hard to get into theaters. And Epstein's new book, The Hollywood Economist, has other fascinating insights, like how cup holders on seats drive up revenue, how states and some foreign countries subsidize studios, and why most multiplex theaters have 299 seats. That's because 300 would trigger a requirement of the Americans for Disabilities Act that every row be wheelchair accessible. Edward J. Epstein is an investigative journalist who's written books on subjects from the Kennedy assassination to the diamond industry. I spoke to him recently about his new book, The Hollywood Economist, The Hidden Financial Realities Behind the Movies. Well, Edward J. Epstein, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, movies once captivated the American public. The audience was enormous. Give us a sense of how much the American public was watching movies decades ago, back, say, in the 40s, as compared to how often we go today.
In the 1940s, it was the national pastime. Approximately 67%, two-thirds of the American public, every week, on the average, went to a movie, and they didn't just simply see a movie. They saw newsreels, they saw cartoons, animation, shorts, a second feature, but it was their weekly pastime. Today, less than 10% of the public, on the average, go to the movies in a week. Now, even with movies like Avatar, they score enormous numbers, but the percentage still doesn't go above 10%. They take their numbers from other movies that are playing at other theaters. You still have less than 10% of the population, and it's been this way for the last 10 years.
You know, one of the differences between the movie business today and, you know, 40 or 50 years ago was that there were fewer theaters, bigger audiences, and bigger screens. Now you have multiplexes with you know, thousands of screens, which means that studios have to produce thousands of prints of their films. Is that a significant expense?
Well, prints now cost roughly, people use the number $1,000 a print. It could be more or less. But so if you're doing 5,000 prints, it's $5 million. Now, if you're doing Avatar, it's not a significant cost. If you're doing a film like Hurt Locker, in which case, you know, your total box office is $8 million. It'll wipe out your entire box office. So it's a significant cost, not as significant as advertising.
But they actually do make actual films on reels. These aren't simply digital computer files that we're seeing in theaters, right?
That's interesting you raised that point, Dave, because now when films are shown digitally, there's a digital file. But the movie companies, the studios, the distributors, whatever we're going to call them, still charge, although this is not something they make public, they still charge the film for what they call a digital copy, even though the digital copy, rather than $1,000, might cost them $50. And they then contribute the money for the digital copies of the movie to help the theaters convert from analog projectors to digital projectors. So they have a basic scam going on, and that is charging for something that doesn't exist. Now, what happens is it adds to the deficit of the individual movies, but helps all the studios together by helping the theaters to convert to digital, which will, in the future, reduce their cost.
So the studio makes a movie, and then its distributor, which is a subsidiary of the same studio, charges a fee, which includes high costs for prints of the movie, which aren't really the major cost, but it's a way of extracting revenue from the film, right, that then gets used to convert the theaters to digital projection.
In the case of digital projection, that's true. In the case of analog projection, which is still the majority of theaters, they actually make a print, but they get a footage allowance from the film labs, which they get back at the end of the year if they use a certain amount of footage. And that reduces their cost by 10 or 20%, which just goes into their treasury and doesn't go to the account of the film. The films are all set up, the titles are set up as off-the-books corporation for the purpose of simply accounting on the film. The actual flow of money into a studio is very different from the money that is credited to the film.
Now, you're right that studios don't really make a lot of money from the box office. I mean, a lot of it goes to the theater owners and to the distributors and to the advertising and printing costs. So where do they make their money if it's not from their theater audience?
Well, the reality of the movie business is very simple. They have a library of movies, of literally thousands of titles. Those titles they can sell over and over again to television stations, to cable networks, to paid television, to put them on video. Now, of course, it's DVD. License them to games. This brings in a steady and major flow of money, which pays for their entire production, the money that they actually earn from the ancillary rights to a movie. And these rights, to keep them flowing, and it's worldwide, it's global, it's not just America, to keep the money flowing in, they need hit movies because they, when they sell a package, and they sell these movies not individually, but they'll sell 20 movies to a paid television network or to a foreign television network, they need a few hits, big hits like Batman or Avatar or whatever you have, to drive the package through the whole system. And they make their money by basically selling the same product over and over again through different platforms. The beginning, it all opens with the theater and the box office. Now, you know, if we go back to the 1940s or earlier, all the money came from the box office, so people still think in terms of the box office as the heart of the business. But that all changed in the 50s when television came in. Now you have 90% of your audience at home, basically, watching television or watching their computer or watching their DVD machine or whatever they have. And because of that, the studios have to have a means of reaching the home audience as well as the audience that actually gets into a car and comes to a movie theater.
What about product placements in films? Is that a major source of revenue?
It's not a major source of revenue to the studios, but it's helpful, especially in independent movies, where people get free computers and free cars to use. They don't get the cars to take home, but they get cars to use during the production, airplane tickets. It helps reduce the budget of a movie. It isn't a major source of money. What is a major source of money is government subsidies. Or even state or city subsidies in America. That could reduce your budget by 25 or 30%. Product placement is more or less, a nice freebie that comes on top of everything else. It's the cream in the coffee, if you like.
Now, when a movie's being made, one of the risks is that an actor or actress will walk off the set, get ill, get injured. What kind of insurance do they have for stars?
Well, you can't make a movie, at least a movie where you have any sort of independent financing, unless you have cast insurance. Cast insurance says that if any of your major players, could be the director or the stars, are incapacitated, the insurance company will compensate you fully, even if it means scrapping the entire production. You'll get back every penny, including script development cost. It's a very expensive cast insurance. It could be 5% of your budget.
Are there some stars that have higher premiums because they have a way of not finishing films?
Well, yes. The insurance companies, one of the things they do is evaluate risk. They're not fools, and they look at every aspect of a star's history, whether they've taken drugs, whether they've been trouble with the police, anything, whether they had an injured arm or leg, anything that might reoccur. I mean, because, again, insurance companies are risking hundreds of millions of dollars in the case of some major films like Terminator 3 against a few million dollars in premium. So they want to make sure that the stars don't do stunts, that not that the stars would do the stunts normally, but they want to make sure that doesn't happen. They want to make sure that the stars don't expose themselves to any risk by playing any sports during the movie or even driving a car in some cases. And they want to make sure that they won't suddenly disappear.
We're speaking with Edward J. Epstein. His new book is The Hollywood Economist. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guest is writer Edward J. Epstein. He writes about the economics of Hollywood. His new book is called The Hollywood Economist. You've written about how difficult it is for independent films to get financed and to find an audience. And I know that when I read, sometimes when I watch films that are described as independent films, it will say that they are distributed, in fact, by one of the big studio names that we know, you know, Paramount or Warner Brothers. What do we mean when we say an independent film?
An independent film is a film that does not have a studio green light. Studios might later pick it up to distribute. They might buy it at a film festival. Sony has an entire division, Sony Classics, which buys films essentially at film festivals. Nowadays, not paying more than $2 million a movie. But an independent film, the major difference between an independent and a studio film is a studio film has a distribution date the day it is greenlit, the day it goes into production. When Wall Street 2 went into production in September of 2009, it knew that it was going to be released April 23rd of 2010. When an independent movie is made, it has no distribution and no distribution date. So it might have to go to film festivals. It might be years later before it gets distributed or might never get distributed. For that reason, it's much harder raising money if you don't know when the money is ever going to be returned to you.
Right. So an independent film, when it's made, there is no assurance that a major studio will distribute it. So how do people finance independent films?
Well, there's been many different attempts to finance independent movies. Sometimes it's rich people finance independent movies. People like William Randolph Hearst made films back in the 1920s. For a long time, they were financed by selling the rights to the film in foreign territories, Germany, France, Japan, and by selling those rights and then borrowing money on the contract that they would be paid for those rights, they were able to finance the movies. But this has become exceedingly difficult in the last few years. And this year, 2010, it's almost impossible to find enough pre-sales to finance a movie.
So in other words, you would sell the assurance that once a film finishes its American run, that the foreign rights would belong to whoever is putting up the financing, and then use that promissory note, in effect, to get a bank loan or some other kind of investment. But you don't really know at that point what kind of success it'll have and whether it'll have a foreign audience, do you?
Well, you don't. You know, if you're a foreign distributor, you don't have to put up any money. You just sign an agreement that if the film is finished and if it plays, sometimes as a contract, it has to play in American theaters, you will put up so much money for the rights to that territory, let's say Germany. So you agree to pay $10 million for the German rights to the movie if it's delivered. Then the movie producer has to go to a bank and say, I would like to borrow $10 million on this note. The bank would say, well, how do we know it'll be finished? Then you have to get a completion bond from essentially an insurance company, which says that we guarantee that the movie will be finished. And that bond might cost you another $1 million. So it's a very complex process, raising money. And this process has been made much more difficult recently because of the end of, say, the DVD market abroad or the shrinking of it abroad. The end of independent distributors in America, so people are no longer sure the movie will be released in America, so foreign distributors don't want it, and the growth of local film industry, all these things have come together. So these days, it's very hard to finance a film other than from investors or angels, or however we want to describe people who are willing to risk money for the pleasure of seeing a film made.
You know, it's a little discouraging as I listen to you describe how all this works and how the studios want to get a teen audience to justify the, you know, tens of millions in advertising and distribution costs that they will incur, and how hard it is for independent producers to get financing to get a film made. Do you think the overall the quality of cinema has been degraded by the finances?
I do think that the quality of movies have been juvenilized, if not degraded, have brought down in their age level and their intelligence by the requisites and the realities of what a studio needs to do to keep money flowing in. You know, I think that everyone in Hollywood would like to make socially relevant and intelligent movies. These are intelligent people in Hollywood, and they would like to make movies like Quentin Tarantino makes. They'd like to make really good movies. The problem is they know that they need an audience to come to the theaters that they can find, and that audience tends to be teenage and high school students and people that basically want action in movies. So more and more, they produce the movies that will produce the audience they need, and somehow they hope that a little money will be available to make the Hurt Lockers or the other movies that they would really prefer to make if they had their way about it, if they had the ability to do what they wanted to do.
Well, Edward J. Epstein, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Edward J. Epstein's book is The Hollywood Economist. You can read the first chapter on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, Ed Ward on a new collection of Wilson Pickett recordings. This is Fresh Air. Wilson Pickett was one of the male singers who defined 1960s soul, along with Sam Cooke, Marvin Gaye, Otis Redding, and James Brown. Rough, where Cooke and Gaye were smooth, urban, where Redding was country, and lush, where Brown was spare, Pickett made a huge impact, then seemed to have vanished. Now Rhino Handmade has released Funky Midnight Mover, a 6-disc collection of Pickett's recordings for Atlantic, where he spent most of his career. Rock historian Ed Ward has this review.
Wilson Pickett was born in 1941 in Alabama, the grandson of a preacher, but as a teenager he fled the cotton fields to Detroit, where his father had moved earlier. He loved to sing and frequently went to Dayton, Ohio, where he performed a bit with a gospel group, the Violinaires. When an up-and-coming Detroit vocal group, the Falcons, lost their lead singer in 1961, Pickett auditioned for them and they snapped him up. His familiarity with Dayton got the Falcons a club gig there, and they introduced I Found a Love, a song Pickett had written with the Falcons bass singer Willie Schofield. The response was so good that the group headed over to Cincinnati to record it at King Records, taking the Ohio Untouchables, the band that had been backing them. They were so powerful, they overloaded the microphones, but the song became a huge hit in early 1962. It was a rich moment. Among the other Falcons were Eddie Floyd and Mack Rice, who became important singers and songwriters, and the leader of the Untouchables was guitarist Robert Ward, a bluesmaster who left soon afterwards for a solo career, leaving the rest of the band to eventually become the Ohio Players. Pickett always had big ambitions, and soon he went solo, recording for a number of labels, most notably Lloyd Price's Double L. Jerry Wexler at Atlantic Records heard Pickett's version of If You Need Me and had Solomon Burke record it. Oddly, Atlantic made no effort to sign Pickett himself until mid-1964, and even then his records didn't do very well. It wasn't until May 1965 when Wexler had the inspiration to try Pickett out in front of the Stax House Band in Memphis that they found the magic formula. Sitting in the studio with white guitarist Steve Cropper, Pickett found that the kid knew his gospel, and after fooling around for a while with something the violinaires used to do, they made history. I'm gonna wait till the midnight hour. That's when my love comes tumbling down. I'm gonna wait till the midnight hour. When there's no one else around, I'm gonna take you. Writing songs with Steve Cropper and two ex-Falcons, Mack Rice and Eddie Floyd, both of whom were now working for Stax, Pickett scored two more smash hits, 634, 5789, and 99.5 Won't Do, before record company politics dictated that he move to Fame Studios in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, for the next sessions. Pretty much all of the music from this period is excellent, with top-notch songwriting, playing, and of course singing. The biggest hit was the song Pickett's best remembered for, written by Mack Rice, who also recorded the original version, and given its title by Aretha Franklin, another Detroiter who played keyboards on Rice's version. Pickett, however, turned it into something else, as 1966 turned into 1967. Mustang Sally. Guess you better slow your Mustang down. Oh, Lord. What I said now. Mustang Sally now, baby. Oh, Lord. Guess you better slow your Mustang down. Oh, yeah. You've been running on. Then, in January of 1969, he did something totally unexpected. Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let her in your heart. Then you can start to make it better. Hey Jude, don't be afraid. You were made to go out and get her. The minute you let her under your skin, then you'll begin to make it better. He'd been hanging out with Fame Studios' new guitarist, a tall blonde kid from Florida named Dwayne Allman, and somehow this guy had convinced him to listen to the Beatles. Even more remarkably, when Hey Jude was released early in 1969, it did well on both the soul and the pop charts. By 1970, though, squabbling between Atlantic and various studios reached such a pitch that the company decided to record Pickett in the new hot place, Philadelphia, and packed him off to work with Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff. The change did him good. The album Wilson Pickett in Philadelphia contained two more smash hits. Girl, try to remember. Have no shoes. We stuck together, just me and you. It took a long time to get what we got today. Now you wanna give it all up for another guy. Baby, I'm telling you. Don't let dream mess fool ya. Don't let it shame. Don't Let the Green Grass Fool You and Engine Number 9 were Pickett's last two hits on Atlantic, though. 2 years later, he left for RCA, where he had moderate success, and then in 1977, he signed with a label Atlantic distributed called Big Tree. Disco was what was happening, and time hadn't been kind to Wilson Pickett, who was now carrying a reputation as a dangerous person to be around. The sessions were mostly uninspired, and buried in his last album was a song that maybe told too much about what was going on in his life. Blame it like you hate me. Girl, you're so mean. You tease, you twist my mind. Then you lay my body down with soft ease. Girl, I don't know about you. Oh, I'm changing, you've been putting me through. It was 1978, and Pickett just couldn't make it happen any longer. He continued to tour and occasionally to record, but his reputation for violence made club owners wary of booking him, and his records didn't sell. He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1991, but found himself in jail a year later for fatally injuring a pedestrian with his car. He went back on the road after his release, but health problems laid him low, and he died in 2006 of a heart attack.
Ed Ward lives in the south of France. He reviewed Funky Midnight Mover, a collection of Wilson Pickett's Atlantic recordings on Rhino Handmade. You can hear several tracks from the album at nprmusic.org. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, and Lauren Krenzel. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals, from physicians and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. From the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. And from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, heavy metal in Baghdad. We talk with two members of the heavy metal band Akraus Akauda. They had problems playing their music under Saddam Hussein and even bigger problems after the American invasion when the band got death threats from insurgents. Join us for the next Fresh Air.